So it's a pleasure to welcome Mr. Paul Banchero today at our institute. Paul Banchero from the College of Creative Studies from Detroit.
Again.
Like yesterday. Exactly. Mr. Banchero has a long career in many different areas. He's associate professor and chair of interaction design at the College of Creative Studies in Detroit. But before that, several startups, I think. The last one is General Cybernetics.
Correct.
Focusing on systems and cybernetics in different areas. So the startup to his guys, he accounts Nokia, Samsung. He was teaching also at New York University, at Stanford University, and also at the MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
A little bit.
And today you're here at our Institute of Design and Communication. Give you a warm hand.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Thank you for coming. I know it's a difficult time at the end of the semester. We had our end of semester some weeks ago, or I wouldn't be here. And I appreciate Carl's kind invitation and Daniel's kind invitation to come and talk to you today. You know about the College for Creative Studies, and you know that there are these four programs. Maria Luisa, of course, yesterday and the day before, was speaking from the Integrated Design Program. And as Daniel just said, I'm chairing the Master's in Fine Arts in Interaction Design. And in a place like this, it's not hard to say that. But in some places, people say, what's that? Do people say that's in Interaction Design? What's that? And I can tell one of two stories, depending on the situation. Sometimes when people say, what's interaction design? I say, well, have you had any interactions today? And I really want them to answer. Because, of course, they think they've asked a question, and they're going to get a response, and then that's it. No. I want an interaction. So did you have any interactions today? How'd they go? They went well. Good. OK, so you don't need an interaction design. But some people say some went well and some didn't go well. And my response to that is, those ones that didn't go well, I want to design those better. And the purpose of that is not just to turn it into an interaction, but to say, I don't care about the technology. I care about the human being. And I want to design from the human being's point of view, not from the technology's point of view. And this is true universally. It can be service design, interaction design, social design, whatever kind of design you want, product design. It's always about the person, and it's always about the interaction for the human being. What does the human being want, and how do they get it, fundamentally? The other story I like to tell, again, depending on circumstances, is there's a famous comedian, a British guy from Monty Python from some years ago, John Cleese. And there was an interview of John Cleese on video that I saw once. And the interviewer starts out by saying, Mr. Cleese, you're a very funny man. And Cleese goes, no, I don't think about it that way. It depends on who I'm with. So perhaps interaction design has as its goal to create conditions such that you can be who you want to be, in this case, a very funny man. Or even better, you can be who you want to become. So again, the purpose of the story is to forget about the particular circumstances of a machine or a product or an organization or a social situation, but to go back to who we are and what we want and what we need. So these are my stories about interaction design. I've been asked to present this lecture, which of course has all of these words in it, like cybernetics and conversation. So the goal that I have of this presentation is to give you my view of design and where conversation fits into design. And by talking about that, I have to talk about cybernetics, and I have to do all of that in an hour. So in sum, I've asked myself to do the impossible, which of course is a good thing because that means I don't have to worry about failing. I know that I won't do everything I want, but at least I can try and I can strive to get somewhere. So I hope you'll come with me on this journey as I parse out what I would like to say. I believe that we design our world every day that we get up in the morning.
We may not be conscious of it, but we decide what to do, perhaps because of a habit of what we've done before, perhaps because there's a new opportunity that we didn't know about, perhaps because someone says, hey, let's go to Graz. This was a new opportunity for me. So making choices and creating and designing our world is something we do every day as individuals. And also as designers, I feel we have a responsibility to do it every day for the world, for our world. And there are many such design challenges in the world today. These are the hardest ones we know. These, of course, are not just challenges of design, they are challenges to design. And we could classify them. We know that they're not simple problems. We know that they're at least complex problems. And then there's this terminology, which you may have heard, called wicked problems. Now, this term, in America at least, is used, oh, that's a really hard problem, that's a wicked problem. But it's meant, if you look up these authors, Rittle and Weber, it's meant in a very specific sense. It's meant in the sense of a problem that's so hard, it's almost impossible to imagine where to begin, such as homelessness. What do we do with the homeless? Well, what's wrong with the homeless? I ask the students, and they say, well, they don't have a home. Oh, fine, so we'll build a bunch of buildings and then we're done, right? No. Right. So then it becomes a matter of a job, or a matter of education, or a matter of mental health, or a matter of economic disparity and social injustice. So these are wicked problems that are not easily defined. And yet these are the biggest and most important challenges of this era. So in the context of designing our world, that's the broadest sense of world, but I also want to include the narrowest sense of every day when we get up in the morning. If you read the abstract, I start out by saying we've been thinking about design from the beginning of language and the beginning of society, right? So we get up in the morning and we think what we might want, and then we act, mind and hand. And this conversation between mind and hand has been taking place as long as we've had language to express these ideas and to have a desire that we can express to each other. And one of the most articulate people I know in this area is a woman named Edith Ackermann. She was a student of Jean Piaget, whom you may know, and a colleague of Seymour Papert, well known in the computers and education field, and also at the MIT Media Lab, where they both were for some years. And her clarity is, I think, very, very important. And I'd like to begin about Edith by showing a quote. Collectively designing a world that is worth living in, designing our world. And she understands this idea of conversation for action. And I'd like to run a little clip of her explaining what she means by this. She uses in this clip the word tinkering, which in some contexts sounds sort of trivial. You know, I'm tinkering, I'm just playing, I'm just fooling around, I don't care. No. She means a very serious thing by tinkering, and she explains it here.
So what I am trying to understand in greater depth is the complex relationship between the mind, the hand, but also the eye, and how the mind, the eye, and the hand can actually achieve their magic if you let them do their things with materials that are rich enough to continue the person actually to want to go to the next step. Importance of the eye and the importance of actually thinking of learning as seeing anew. And I believe that in your tacit way of thinking about tinkering, for you the eye is very important. And yet, we always talk about the head and the hand and the tool. And the playfulness in it all comes from the fact that instead of just looking for the reasons why you don't get what you wanted, the creative side of tinkering comes when you actually almost voluntarily sometimes put yourself in such a way that you can see it differently as a result of tinkering. So this act of, I put myself aside, I backtrack, just to allow myself to look at something in more than one way, is a key to interesting forms of tinkering. Because otherwise tinkering is nothing else than trial and error. And I want it to be something different. So it's in that sense that I insist heavily on the seeing side of things. In the very definition of tinkering, it all comes down with the ways in which you look at the discrepancy between what you got, what you thought you got, and what you read as having gotten when you made a move. And not enough attention has been paid to our ability to let ourselves see different things, even in one image.
There's a great deal in that. And one of the things that's in that that may not be obvious is she's doing what in English we call a takedown. You know what a takedown is? A takedown is when you criticize something and you show it to be not as valuable as or as important as it might be. So you might have a great idea and someone does a takedown of your idea by pulling it apart and showing the flaws in it. What she's doing is she's pulling apart and showing the flaws in the motto, mens et manus, mind and hand, of a very famous institution of MIT. She's saying mind and hand is not enough. You also have to have the eye. And it's the eye that provides this additional participant in a conversation when you're drawing something and you're seeing the drawing from a separate point of view. This is what she was just talking about. You step outside and you look back inside and you see something new, as she says, so that you can see something new. This is a conversation. You're having a conversation with yourself. You can say it's with the pencil or with the paper or with the artifact that you're making. But it's really you and you taking different perspectives. So conversation is inherent in design, even though we don't think about it that way. This character, Ranulph Glanville, was actually on my dissertation committee, and a designer and an architect, and has many extraordinary writings in this regard. And I invite you now just to read a bit about what he says about this. This is the act that makes design design. This is conversation. So this is a setup that I'm giving you, a kind of context of everything. Now, my full title, of course, has this word cybernetics in it, which is always problematic, because many people have an impression of what it is, given by the popular media, or by robot movies, or by artificial intelligence. Let me start with a definition of design that is actually a cybernetic definition of design. So I'm going to tell you what cybernetics is by showing you a definition. This was written by a scientist in the 60s. Everyone designs. I love this beginning. It's not saying designers are precious and they do what they do over there. Oh, I'm a designer. Everyone designs. Who devises courses of action, who says, I am going to go in this direction for a certain reason, aimed at changing what I have now, because I don't like what I have now, I'm looking at it, I don't like it, I want to change it, into something that I prefer. I think this is familiar. This doesn't sound like what a designer does. In every project you have a problem, you want to make the situation of the problem better, right? This is not contentious in any way. But I want to tell you, by defining cybernetics, by saying, this is pure cybernetics. Cybernetics comes from the word in Greek, meaning to steer. If you remember nothing else from this lecture, remember that cybernetics is not robotics, okay? Cybernetics is steering. It comes from the Greek word meaning to artfully steer, to steer with skill. It means that there's a goal over there and I set out in my ship, it's a Greek metaphor, and I am going fine and then I'm blown off course by wind and tide and I see, hey, wait a minute, I want to go over there, but I'm going
So I correct. I use the information called feedback of the difference between where I'm going, my current situation, and my preferred situation, and I correct with action. But maybe I overcorrect and I go too far, so I have to correct again. This feedback loop is the fundamental of cybernetics. Nothing else is more fundamental than cybernetics. If you build a robot, you need this. You need a lot of things. You need cybernetics if you're building an HVAC system, what we call in America. You're building a heating system or an air conditioning system, right? What do? You say, it's too hot. Turn on the air conditioner. How am I doing? It's still too hot. Keep the air conditioner on. How am I doing? It's cool enough. Fine. Turn off the air conditioner. And then you wait until it gets warm again. Pure cybernetics, okay? Now, if cybernetics has the form of design, then how does it help us think about what the design process is? So again, this is Herb's argument. Glanville doesn't beat around the bush, as we say in English. He goes right for it. He says, they're the same thing. It's this process of adjusting toward some goal. Now, there are many issues there. Who sets the goal? How do you set the goal if it's homelessness and on and on? And we'll get to some of that. So a colleague of mine and I have been working on this idea that we can construe, define, create an interpretation of design as a conversation for action, namely cybernetics. So if I'm aiming my boat and I'm trying to get to the port as a steers person, I'm having a conversation with myself. How am I doing? How am I doing? In the same way that if we're designing, we have the same kind of conversation. We also claim that cybernetics is a necessary foundation. I know you didn't realize that. But this is what we're trying to put out that we feel is valuable and new. So this is in the realm of design methods, design research, design methodologies. Now let me make this argument for you. Okay, so if you have a seatbelt, put it on. You'll need a little bit, and then it'll get better. Okay. I'm going to try to make a strong argument here. If you're designing, you have to understand systems. That's what this is claiming. Now, I think you know that already. You may not articulate it in quite the same way. But of course, digital is everywhere. And digital, this device on my desk here, is a system of systems. There's hardware talking to software, talking to networks, talking to databases, talking to people, talking to network. Systems of systems. I think this is kind of straightforward. Now, Internet of Things, of course, is an example of that. Design these days is no longer giving form. It's no longer just the shape of something, as it may have once been in creating chairs or artifacts or whatever. But it's creating systems that support interactions. Now, human interactions span thinking and acting. Right? So we must model and tame this complex mesh of mechanisms, mechanical, electrical, technological, physical, and human. And therefore, systems literacy is something that we feel is foundational in being a designer. And Dubberly has written beautifully on these things. There are many papers that I can help you find of his and presentations to make this assertion. Now, if you're going to systems, you need cybernetics, we claim. Why do we claim that? Well, there are digital interactions that are about reliable connections and so on. But there are also human interactions, goals, methods to achieve goals, etc. Now, the science of communication and feedback, interaction and purpose, is cybernetics. So therefore, we must model communication and intention in a common frame because we want all of these things to be modelable together. Not, oh, over here we do the human part and over here we do the mechanical part. No, we want the same frame. And cybernetics lets us do that, and therefore cybernetics is important for design. Now, second order cybernetics. I'm explaining first order for the first time, and here I am going into second order. I apologize for it. But you know this idea already in the same way that you knew the idea of basic cybernetics or first order cybernetics already. You knew what it's like when you're trying to steer something or you're on a bicycle or you're trying to design something. You know already that those are processes of saying, I want to go there, how am I doing?
you act and see whether you can get there or not. Similarly, second order cybernetics. You know already. Second order cybernetics begins with you looking at your looking. So a minute ago we were looking at the air conditioning system and I was describing it. Now, if I were to describe it in detail, I would say, well, there's a sensor and the sensor determines the temperature of the air. And if it's too warm, it turns on the cooler. And then it monitors that and it's this loop. Now, why didn't I talk about the water that's in the chiller, the cooler? Why didn't I talk about the electricity? Why didn't I talk about how long the wires are? Because those things are not relevant to the description of achieving a purpose. But also, I chose them. I chose what to talk about and what not to talk about. So I'm responsible for the subjective viewpoint that I have on this thing I'm trying to describe. Just when you're trying to solve a problem and you say it's about X, it's not about Y, that's your opinion. It's not a truth. It's your truth. It's something that you could argue for. But it's not absolute. So second order cybernetics is the acknowledgement that there is no truth, but it's a matter of subjective point of view. And for a designer, it's the ability to argue for that point of view. It's like, I have this idea, you have that idea. Let's go have a conversation and see where the best idea comes out. It's not my right and you wrong, or vice versa. So second order cybernetics is this thing that becomes a tool for framing the wicked challenges. Because if I say homelessness is about money or about social standing or about education, I have to be able to defend that. So you see what we're trying to do. We're trying to create an argument, a rationale for going in this direction. There's one more. There have been some hints of this already. So if you're going to tame one of these wicked problems or wicked challenges, you have to be able to argue with someone else your point of view. So another way to say it is, we feel that designers must be articulate about the reasons why they choose what they choose. If I say it's going to be 50 pixels square and green, I have to be able to say why, because everybody else on the team is going to say, well, why, Paul? Why are you making that choice? If I can't have a rationale for it, if I can't support it, if I can't justify it, then maybe it's a really bad idea. How does the rest of the team know it's a good idea if I can't articulate it? Conversation. We have to agree. If we don't agree on what we're trying to do, then we're not going to get anywhere. So agreement is a precursor to acting together. Okay? So we're trying to be very tight about this. One reason to try to be very tight is people over some decades have tried to make arguments for design methodology. So why should design be this and not something else? How do we get rigorous about design? Well, if you get too rigorous, then you're not being creative. Can you be creative and rigorous? What does rigor mean in that context? These are the kinds of things we're interested in. So, part of the idea of the talk is to introduce some characters I've met along the way. You can take your seatbelts off now. Heinz von Forster, a Viennese, actually, which is why I was in Vienna this past week to give a talk at his institute. He's passed away. It's an institute in honor of him. Was very important to the movement of second-order cybernetics. And Gordon Pass was my dissertation instructor, advisor, I should say, when I did a PhD some years ago, in his work. And his work is conversation. And although people sometimes think of him as a theoretician, he built a whole bunch of machines, and I wish I had time to describe machines. He was a maker before we had that word, and he developed his theory from the machines he built. And they were interactive, and they were conversational, and they were amazing in what they did with electromechanical relays from the 1950s. And so, but it's a story for another time. Ask me over coffee sometime.
But what he did was he started studying two different participants with observers recording equipment in between. And he extrapolated a theory of conversation. And he developed these diagrams to explain the procedures and the layers and the interactions that take place in the conversation. And I teach a version of this in a frameworks course that's one of the foundation courses in the interaction design program at CCS, so that students can express what happens in conversation, because it's a very important part of interaction. Because I'm thinking in my head, even as I'm using this thing, it's the conversation back and forth. And of course, even more so if I'm designing a social environment and I'm speaking to you through the medium, then I want to understand what the power and limitation of the channel might be. So this is all implicit in this. This is a very interesting diagram. This diagram, although it may be hard to tell, is the design of a conversation with a machine. The machine is on the right side, and the person is on the left side. About designing. So the computer's on the right, and it's not just in the case of architecture, which is this example. It's not just doing a rendering and the 3D shading and calculating the size of the beams and so on. It's actually trying to have a back and forth about why are we building this building? Why have we chosen this particular structure? Because of course, if you're having a conversation with your colleagues about design, you're saying, why are we trying to do something and how are we trying to do it? And that's this double layer. This is a layer of goals, and this is a layer of means to achieve those goals. And down here is the environment in which you're building artifacts and prototypes, and you're sketching, and you're trying to understand what the implication is. Now, this idea of an architecture machine was the foundation of a lab at MIT called the Architecture Machine Group, which was started by Nicholas Negroponte. And I worked there for some years, a couple of years. And the goal of that group was to build a machine that had a conversation with a person. We never got there. We never got there for a number of reasons, partly because it's very hard, and partly because even though there had been some examples that were built way back when, the lab became the media lab. And once the media lab started, it was about hardware and software and other kinds of things, sponsorship, and so on. And so the idea of a conversation with a machine got left behind. But now, in the same way that I told you a little bit about what cybernetics is, I have to tell you what I think design is in another layer of detail. Do you know the term design thinking? Good, some of you know, prefer design thinking, of course. And maybe to some it's a branding thing, and to others it's in contrast to analytical thinking. But if you think about it as a methodology, it's mostly these three processes. And if you're familiar with it, I can zip through this, right? So it's user-oriented research, a form of ethnography, basically. It's generating ideas, and it's making and testing and making and testing. Well, one question is, how do we know how we're doing? And if we iterate, how do we know that we're converging? These are some questions I have about it. And how do we know whether we're doing things that are specific and repeatable? Anyway, I think there are some vague aspects of it that I would like to move beyond. And I'd like to ask the question, how do we measure improvement for users? Did what we build achieve the user's goals? And then, of course, there are our goals as designers, which I think we have to ask the question for. So there's a lot of discussion here about what we're trying to do, and my proposal is that we're really trying to have a conversation. We're observing, we're brainstorming, and we're prototyping. But we're really trying to have a conversation on agreeing the means to do what we're trying to do. So my first substitution is to take all of that design thinking thing and put it in this box called a conversation to agree on the means. Means, methods, techniques, the hows. Now, along the way here, I snuck in the word, and you heard it a few times, about design goals.
But this big box that we have doesn't say anything about the goals for the design. It says only about the means for the design. So if I were to continue on this, I would say that the conversation to agree on means is only one aspect, and there's a conversation to agree on goals. You should recognize this as something you do, even though you may not think about it. Right, because part of the time you're saying, how are we going to do it? And part of the time you're saying, well, what are we trying to do? So I just want to be explicit about that. So does doing that achieve that, right? If I build this, will I achieve my goals? And of course, you may be revising each. There's a concept, too, of who's in the conversation. In other words, if the four of us were to form a design team, do we have the right people in the group? Is there anybody missing? The concept that comes from cybernetics in this is called variety. Sometimes it's called diversity, which has some political overtones. Very similar idea. Technically, the variety means, what are our capabilities? If there's only the four of us on this team, what can we do and what can we not do? And so you have to design for the variety in the conversation, because at one moment we might be fine, we don't need anybody else. But then there's this moment where we don't have a screen designer, we don't have a network designer, we don't have someone who understands the capabilities of the population that we're talking about. So this goes on. We need variety everywhere. And I'd like to take a brief excursion into designing the design composition.
Everybody okay?
I know it's kind of heavy. I don't think you need your seatbelts anymore.
We do have a little ways to go. I hope you're okay.
It's an intense week, I know.
Sorry to confer with you with something.
So let's imagine we have a conversation, and there are three of us in this conversation. And that's these little E's. Person one, person two. Have a conversation for design. And we just, well, what's the outcome of that? Is there an outcome? I hope probably learn something. I hope. But now we're going to have another conversation later. Usually what happens is we say, great, that was great, I'll meet you again Monday at 10. See you. And we do nothing in between. But if we're going to design the conversation, we should think about what the next conversation needs. Needs in terms of who should be in that conversation. Maybe these participants are different. And maybe they come from a larger group of possible participants. And also maybe we should bring some knowledge with us. We need to bring this fact, this research, the stuff that we didn't know in the first meeting to the second meeting. So this selection mechanism becomes very important. And usually people later on ask me questions about the power structures involved in the selection mechanism. But I'll leave that to them. This can also become a pattern where, for example, in the advertising industry, which is why I did this project originally, the catalyst is the client calls the agency, you have an ideation phase where you generate possibilities, you choose a solution, you deliver the solution, you evaluate it. But it forms the same pattern. I suppose the lesson here is don't design the team, because that implies the same people every week. Design the conversations, or the sequence of conversations. So, there's obviously something missing here. You knew that. And what is it? Well, I need to be brief, but I need to go sideways again. So this is Heinz von Forster again, and this is a character named Michael Gagan, who was a colleague and client of mine for many years. And he and I, and also Hugh Dubberly, who I've already mentioned, produced a book about organizational design. And if any of you are interested in that particular subset of design, you know. Really what I'm trying to do in this second excursion is show you what's inside the boxes. I won't do all four, but I need to. Now, you don't need to read the right side of this, but the left side here, some people argue with me about. I don't mean German or English or French or language. I mean, how do we think? What are the distinctions that we do
vocabulary? What are the relationships we have? If I can't think about it, I can't do anything about it. Seems obvious, right? So if our language isn't powerful enough, then I might not be able to solve the problems in front of me. I think that's pretty straightforward, right? We need the power of language, the power of understanding and expression in order to solve a given problem. Now, what happens in organizations, businesses in particular, is it narrows language to get better and better and cheaper what it's already doing. You all use acronyms when you talk amongst yourselves. You have terminology that you use. What you don't realize is that that acronym is a limitation. It means that you're always going to think what the acronym means, and you're less likely to say, wait a minute, maybe that idea is not expansive enough, or maybe that's not the right idea, I need this thing. So you're stuck in a rut. Language always narrows what you can think. Now, this is the consequence of that, is it increases your ignorance. Ignorance in the sense of not being able to know, not stupidity, right? This is a distinction in English that's often lost. Ignorance in English means I was never exposed to that, and so I can't be responsible for having known it. It doesn't mean you knew it and you forgot it. So therefore, the language that you're using from the past, and right now I'm using my language from the past, that's all I have. It's limiting what I can see in the future. So if you're an organization, and you're trying to watch the environment, and you're trying to see what's going on, if you don't change your language, you're going to be stuck in the past, and you're going to fail. And more companies fail than succeed. Just that. So that's the bad news. The good news is if you can expand your language, then you can increase your opportunity. And this is the lesson of this. To regenerate an organization, you have to create new language. Now, there's a way to talk about that, but that's beyond the scope of time today. It's not easy to do. It's a design problem of its own. But that's what's in this square. It's a conversation to create new language. How am I doing on time? Did we start 35 ago? I've gone 40 so far. Okay. Well, I want to tease you a little bit. Since I've been mentioning the various gurus that I've known, I have to mention Stafford Beer, who was really this extraordinary character. And he invented something called the viable system model, which I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but I'm mentioning it. It was in the abstract of the talk. Oops, it skipped ahead. This is the environment, this blob on the left. And on the right is his model of an organization. And it has a very, very specific and detailed structure, which I'm not going to burden you with today. It's based on a combination of how the nervous system is organized in a series of hierarchies. So if you read his work, you say, oh, that part is, you know, the cortex, and that part is the nervous system, and so on and so forth. And what I've started to do is an analysis of how my model of these four squares maps into Stafford's work. And again, if you're interested in organizational design and management, he's the man. One reason to mention him, and this is a little known fact, is he worked in Chile in the 70s, in the early 70s. He worked for Allende. And he did a project called CyberSyn, CyberSyn. There are many things on the web about it. Now, Chile's a very, very long country. And his idea was to have one place in the capital, in Santiago, where at 9 o'clock in the morning, you would know everything that took place in the economy the night before. What was the output of the factories? What was sold? What was mined from the earth? So that you could regulate this very, very complex economy that had this peculiarity of being stretched out. It's true of any economy, but he was interested in that particular one. He was trying to do this when the most effective way of communicating the information from one end of the country to another was something called a telex machine. You know what that is. It's a typewriter that sits here and goes chunter, 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 and prints something out and gives me a piece of paper like an automatic typewriter. That was the best they had. But because he had this cybernetic approach, and because he was looking at systems, he could design an idea that couldn't be built yet. He could conceive of a way of understanding what the economy was doing on a day-to-day basis, because he went from this conceptual idea to whatever technology was available. Now, you could do this today in a heartbeat, and to some extent, governments and organizations try to do, but not the way he did, because they weren't as informed by his model as they might have been.
So, like Edith Ackerman, I feel like Stafford's work is not available as much as it ought to be because of the power and capability that it brings. Okay. So this is a kind of slow wrap-up of the journey that we've had. I said this before. Action may either conserve or change a situation. This is a very interesting statement. And here's a longer version of it. Now, I'm sure you're thinking, how is design a conversation about what to conserve and what to change? Did anyone think that? Or maybe you're all too hot. As designers, we want to make a change, right? That's what cybernetics is. It's like, I want to go there, but I'm going here instead, and I want something else. Something is one way, and I want it to be another way. We agree that this is what designers want. They want change. We want change. But the valuable part about this point of view is that we can first reflect and say, what do we not want to lose when we make this change? So if we're going to have a social innovation, or if we're going to make a phone, or if we're going to use Facebook, we want a lot of stuff from those things, but what do we not want that's new? What do we want to conserve? What do we value in ourselves as human beings, as social creatures, as people who want to live together? What do we want to keep? What do we not want to lose? And I love this idea of thinking about what we're trying to make better in the context of what we don't want to lose that's underneath it all. And this idea comes from yet another character, Humberto Maturana, who happens to be Chilean, although he wasn't working on the project I mentioned a minute ago with Stafford Beer. He's a biologist. And he, with some colleagues, redefined how the biological field thinks about living things. That's how profound his point of view has been. And I don't want to go into those details. He was at he came in via video at a conference in Toronto last October, and this video is available online. And these links, by the way, are in this PDF. I'll make it available through Daniel after the talk if you want to look any of this up. I want to read you a comment from Maturana, a quote, and then we're getting toward the close. So Maturana is here talking about the difference between human beings as opposed to all living creatures. He's a biologist, right? He's interested in that comparison. So in the context of talking about human beings as being different, he says, the only thing peculiar to us is that we human beings consciously choose the path we follow. We consciously choose the path we follow in the conservation of our living. This is a phrase he often uses. The conservation of our living. What do we want to keep? What do we not want to lose when other things change? Because we consciously choose the path we follow, we are therefore responsible for what we choose. And as designers, we are responsible for what we choose. I would say further, we're responsible not only for the values that we have, but to state those values transparently, such that you can decide if you agree with my values and therefore take what I have designed. Because if I hide my values, which Google does, which Facebook does, ask me a question about that. If I hide my values, then I'm not being ethical. And as designers, this applies. Maturana has this wonderful phrase of living together in languaging. He makes a distinction between all the other creatures and those of us who talk and have language. We are living together in language. We think we live together in a physical space. Yes, of course we do. But it's the social interactions and the linguistic interactions that are where we derive value, where we understand how we feel about each other and about what we want. And this comes from Maturana. So here's my final logical run. So this is my proposal to replace design thinking with design of conversations for action, because I believe that these problems need a more powerful methodology. And the way Deverly and I express this in the paper is in terms of what we call second order design, which we define as facilitating the emergence of conditions in which others can design. So the way this goes is, oh, I design for you. That's the way it used to be when I might design the chair and the chair gets manufactured. Actually, before that, as a craft, when we're in a village, right, I design and I make something and I offer that to you. Then design with is the idea of today, which is user-centered design. So I design with the conversation with the users. The next generation of that is designers enable others to do their designing, to design their world, to get up in the morning and have their iPhone help them be who they want to be and become who they want to become. Not to design for them, but to let them design. Second order. Now this idea of choice comes back to Heinz von Forsten, who felt that human beings, not only designers, but human beings, really have to act to increase possibilities, not just for themselves, but for others. And by choices, he meant something, not just options. I could give you 50 options of what you might eat, but in fact, you might be vegetarian, you might not like curry, and you might be allergic to pepper. I'm describing myself. So therefore, these 50 choices are not options for me, but three of those choices are really good possibilities for me. And so you would only give me the three, you would not give me the 50. But then maybe you might offer four and five and increase my choices, and you are helping me design my world in that case. And this is ethical in part because, as Heinz also said, I'm better off if you're better off. So if I help you, I help myself. He also said, if you desire to see, learn how to act. Namely, we don't know what we know by thinking. We know what we know by acting. And we can act in ethical ways. We can act for design, we can act as Edith encourages us, with the mind, the eye, and the hand. Thank you very much.
irony is not lost on me to be talking so much about conversation and yet to be giving a lecture. It doesn't make sense to me. But thank you for your patience to that.
What are your reactions, criticisms, aversions? I know this word aversion is that one. Did I say something where you thought, oh? Because there's information in that reaction, even if it's intuitive.
Do you think, like in the language part, when you not only use the like change the words you're using, like acronyms, but also you change the language you're using, like real language of German and English? And do you think you could also like change the culture or like the culture of a company?
Absolutely. I think the words are the distinctions and concepts. The relationships among them are the meaning that those words make. A word on its own doesn't mean anything. Some people will tell it's in the context of certain situations and that it means something. And language and culture are inextricably mixed. You can't pull one out and have the other one not change. So yes, I agree completely that it's culture as much as language. It's hard to talk about language sometimes because people get stuck on words or on German versus English. How are you thinking about this? What are the constructs in your head and what are the values and emotions under the constructs in your head that affect what you do and who you are and how you interact? So I see them very much together. About the openness to being willing to change. And in the organizational design book that I showed you, a great book as we call it, we discuss in there the resistances to change, particularly inside of corporate culture, where very often those in power don't want the change. So they hire expensive consultants to come in and pretend that something is changing. But the main thing is their power doesn't change, because that's what they do, is they preserve the power. So that's one group in an organization that's not really happy about change. But it's also, to some extent, human nature. I mean, this person you're talking about had the freedom to be open to change. But if you're working every day and you're really slammed and you're anxious about your future, human nature makes you more closed and conservative and less open to having change occur. And there are many other resistances in big organizations to organizational change. And we discuss in the little great book some of the ways that you work around that. Mostly you let people be who they are, and you try to attract as few people like your friend who would be willing to try something new. And you incubate that off to the side, and you protect it from what's going on in the mainstream. Because everybody in the mainstream is going to say, why are you doing that? Why are you spending money on that? You're wasting your time. What about today's business? You're talking about the future. We're fine. We're going to survive. Because in their language, they can't see. They don't have the framework of seeing that they're going out of business.
So,
you're talking about changing the language in organizations. So, but it doesn't mean the international part. It's not that the priority of languages, it's the way people are talking with each other. Is this right?
Yes.
And what kind of organizations? Is it in general? to change.
Yeah.
And I think, is it the language which we're... Because I think, what exactly means with language, you know what I mean? because is it the mindset?
Mindset, yes. Beliefs, values.
Beliefs, values, okay. So
what you pay attention to and what you can't see.
Okay, so it's not really... Not only the conversation, the whole package.
Yeah. If you it's difficult to explain briefly, I'm sorry, I can't do a better job, but if you can't think about it, you can't do anything about it. If we can't speak about it, then we can't have a collaboration about it, and we can't act together about it. It's really who talks to whom about what is the organization, is the team, is the product design group, is the nonprofit, is the community, is the family. Been in a family where certain topics you're not allowed to talk about. I can't do anything about those. So yes, that's thank you for the question.
So can the sentence change in the language be a metaphor for stepping out of your comfort zone?
Yes. Being willing to change the language means that you were willing to step out of your comfort zone.
What do you mean by saying asking about Google and Facebook, what you can do is
So this comes under a story I tell called The Parable of Luigi's Pizza. Okay? Ready for the parable. So ask me where is there good pizza? Right across the street, Luigi's. Now ask me why is it good pizza? Screw you, I'm not going to tell you. Would you talk to me again?
No.
Thank you.
I would ask, why are you sneaking?
Good. So now you can ask the metaphor. I just described Google. You get it? You can't ask Google, why are you mean to me? Nor can you ask it, why is it better pizza? Now, as a friend, I may say, well, you know, if the real Neapolitan's running the oven, and the oven came from Naples, and they use, you know, great olive oil, and they have great service. And I think you'll like it, Sophia, because I know you appreciate these things. Or it might be, you know, you're gluten intolerant, and you need gluten-free, and they have great options that are gluten-free. That's a more personal thing. Now, Google, of course, is personalizing. It knows things about you, and it knows a hell of a lot else that you don't know it knows about you. And it's making choices for you or for it. Can I get back to you on that? I'm not sure. No, of course it's making choices for it. Facebook, of course, is even worse. So we tolerate these things. We tolerate being mistreated. We tolerate being treated unethically, because it's not transparent, because we get something from it. But we don't even keep in mind that there's something going on here that is not something we would tolerate from a human being. Why do we tolerate it from a machine? Shouldn't our standards be higher with machines? People are flawed, we can forgive them. Anyway, that's the story. Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope that some ideas resonated. I hope that you'll remember them. As time goes on, feel free to write to me. The easiest way is paul@pandera.com. And a different version of this talk and related slides are available at pandera.com/gf17. And I hope that you carry something with you from this. Gordon Task, again, my dissertation instructor, liked to say that once started, conversations never end. And he meant it in the sense that you can write to me and I can respond. But he also meant it in a more profound way. What he meant was that these ideas have had some impact on how you think. And tomorrow or next month or maybe a year from now, you may remember something from it. And then you will have a conversation in your head about the difference between what you thought about it today and what you think about it
a month from now. And that conversation will continue, and that's what you meant. So I look forward to continuing the conversations. Thank you very much again.
Yeah.